Well, it's been a while since we've done this.
Has been.
We should do them more often. But then we always say that.
We do. We always say that. So, you know what we should start with first is this whole SSL thing. So we converted packetpushers.net to SSL, and then things happened.
Because we should, right? We converted it to HTTPS by default.
Seems like the right thing.
Seems like the right thing. A, it's faster. So theoretically, when you use it, it actually tests faster under SSL or HTTPS than it does under HTTP because there's some streamlining of the connectivity. But when you set the website up to be HTTPS, it also SSLs, or more correctly, TLSs, all of the RSS feeds. And not all of your podcast clients can run TLS. And so some of you had problems with the feeds, for which we're sorry. We've now rolled back the change. We tried to do some stuff, but it didn't work. And if your feeds have frozen, and so iTunes particularly is a culprit here, you'll need to delete and resubscribe to the channel that you wanted to listen to.
You also might have got some double feed information, some exciting flood showed up on Twitter and so on because of this. And, we'll fall on our swords on YouTube. Would that be acceptable? We could do that.
It's one of these things. You try and keep moving up, and then you have this problem. So you want to be HTTPS because of speed, and then you suddenly realize that when you change them over, the RSS engines. Oh, we had the Twitter spam as well.
Yeah.
And that was because the software, we use a thing called Zapier to detect a publishing in the RSS feed. And when you shift to SSL, Zapier thinks it's a whole new...
New items! I'm so excited! Woo! And it just went crazy. Just, I mean, we automated at scale, baby, and failed at scale.
Nothing like a cloud to fail at scale. Sorry about that too, I guess. Apologies for that. We had tried to delete the tweets, so they didn't show up. So if you just didn't happen to be online at the time, it wouldn't affect you so much.
We sat there and just hammered away at deleting tweets. But enough about that. We just wanted to bring it up and acknowledge, we did it. We're trying to get better. And it didn't go as well as planned. Perhaps we need ITIL. If only we had an ITIL process to have fallen back on, Greg. That probably would have saved this whole tragedy.
What we need is more into automation and more disaggregation.
That's what we need. So will disaggregation become the industry norm, Greg, is a question I have here. And this comes up because I was briefed by Avaya yesterday. I did a write-up on packetpushers.net about it. They have it disaggregated. We haven't heard much from Avaya lately, and at least not from their switching division. And what Randy Cross, one of their senior something or another of Fabrics and Infrastructure, very impressive title. Anyway, he's just a good guy. I've met him in person a few times. He's one of the good people. He said, we've been heads down on this whole disaggregation thing. So they took VSP. That's the OS that's got SPB inside. And disaggregated, meaning you can run it on ODM hardware, some kind of a generic white box switch that currently they're partnered with Delta Networks for this. Delta. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's a company that makes switches, and normally they sell them to other companies, but now you're hearing about them for the first time.
There's a whole bunch of other ones, Acton and Quanta, and I forget, there's a list. I just happened to partner with Delta for this one.
Oh, there's dozens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Companies making switches. I always thought there might be like three or four, and I was shocked to learn that there's dozens of companies that make Ethernet switches in China.
I did not know dozens. I was thinking of about a half a dozen. It's about a half a dozen or maybe eight names that show up pretty often. Because they're the ones that also have their own, they'll stick a brand on it and sell it. And so you kind of hear of them frequently. I documented them a while back on my blog, but I've kind of forgotten a lot of the names because you don't hear them every day.
I'm also discovering there's a lot more silicon than just Broadcom, right? Obviously, we talk about Cavium. P4 this week introduced its Tofino silicon programmable pipeline silicon chip. But there's also a whole range of companies who are making the smaller silicon, right? So normally we think about the Jericho chip, which came out in Arista switch, or the Tomahawk, which was the Dell and the HP switches that they announced recently. We talked about those.
Mm-hmm.
And but there's other companies down there making 24-port 1-gig switches or 48-port 1-gig silicons. Or there was another company I was talking to. I talked about it on the network break, and they're making industrial silicon. So a little switch chip that fits into like about the size of a paperback book, if you remember back in the days when paperback books were a thing. Like small 8 ports of 1 gig and 2 SFPs for backhaul and, you know, all this fancy stuff. There's a whole range of companies. It's not just the ones that you know about. There's a whole ecosystem in there that I didn't know existed until I started scratching away at it, which was quite an interesting find, I think.
Well, and it does kind of relate to this question, will disaggregation become the industry norm, where like with PCs, we buy a server and then you stick an OS on it. Do we buy switch hardware from one of apparently dozens of potential suppliers and then stick a NAS on it of our choice, whatever that might be? And, you know, one opinion is, yeah, because the economics are going to just make it an obvious business decision. It's going to be cheaper, presumably here, to buy a white box switch and cheaper than to license a NAS from your vendor of choice, whether that's Avaya or presumably if everyone gets on board to Cisco or Juniper or whoever it might be, and then off you go. And if that's true, and the business decision is what's driving it ahead, then maybe that will become the norm.
Hmm. Well, I mean, we've already seen, I've got a list over on Packet Pushers. I've got a thing called the Virtual Toolbox, which we all contribute to. And it's packetpushers.net virtual-toolbox, which is where we try and collect lists of stuffs, if you will. Try is an active word, but we're actively putting it in. And one of them is a list of network operating systems. And so if you think about it, right, how many people out there are making disaggregated operating systems today, right? You've got Cumulus Networks, Big Switch, Switch Lite, Open Network Linux, Pika 8, it's got their own. Dell has, obviously there's FTOS, but that's not disaggregated, but they've now got Dell OS 10.
OS 10, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You've got IP Infusion. Have you ever heard of that one? With their OCNOS.
Yep, they announced with Dell. I've reviewed it in some detail. I think I might have been involved in giving an award for Interop because it's packed with features, since they're the ones that supply to part of the stacks to a lot of the other networking vendors we know and love.
That's what they've been doing for the last 20 or 30 years, is exactly. Literally making the software that runs in vendor software across the board, by the way, Cisco, Juniper, Brocade, Extreme, everybody. Cisco hasn't disaggregated yet, but we've seen some comments coming out saying they will. If needs to, they will. But keep in mind that they've got, at least six operating systems inside the company today. So in a sense, they're already disaggregated, if you want to look at it like that.
And the first step for them logically would be the Nexus version that runs on the 3K platform?
Yeah.
Because they've already got the pieces and parts there to do the disaggregation there. And also that would cater to the customers that would like to do such a thing.
Mm. Nexus is disaggregatable.
Yes.
There are persistent rumors going around that customers are buying some products from Cisco and then running their own operating systems on them. But I've never been able to get that on the records. It's just rumors, and I don't know if it's real or not. I think it might just be scuttlebutt, but, you know, who knows?
So, okay, this brings up another question that's, you know, I've got this buried later in this wall of text that we wrote to prepare for this show. But, you know, let's say disaggregation does become an industry norm. You've got Broadcom, yes, lots of other silicon manufacturers as well, but Broadcom is the heavy hitter, making the majority of the chips that are going into white box Ethernet switches. How does Cisco counter that if disaggregation is the norm? And we've all been thinking about Cisco in terms of software, right? Well, it's iOS, it's NXOS, it's the various families. They need to be able to, you know, make those run on a white box switch and so on, forgetting or kind of overlooking, I guess, the very obvious fact that Cisco pushes as much hardware out the door as Broadcom does. They're absolutely massive. You know, Greg, point a while back that you could consider Cisco to be a merchant silicon provider in their own right.
Yeah. I think that Cisco is going to do all the things, right? It's selling $12 billion a quarter of switching, right? And by any stretch of the imagination, they are going to be the most significant vendor for the foreseeable future. Things are changing one way or the other. Cisco is likely to stay dominant in the market for the foreseeable future. But there's equally enough money left in the ecosystem for small companies to survive, obviously, because they continue to survive, right?
Because you only need a small piece of the very large pie, right?
That's right. And their profit margins are so vast. We'll talk about that later on as well, right? But I think that Cisco is going to be, there'll be divisions inside of Cisco that are going to produce custom silicon, and they're going to ship it and say, our product's best because it's got custom silicon in it. And I suspect that there are divisions inside of Cisco which are already saying, we're going to use merchant silicon and open operating systems and knock yourself out. And then customers can choose which one they want.
Well, I'm suggesting here that Cisco is going to open up some of their hardware and say, we're Cisco, this is our silicon, not Broadcom, and we want to open up this platform so that you, Dell, IP Infusion, whoever you might be, can run your open operating system on this silicon.
I don't think that will ever happen. I think Cisco's value proposition to customers has always been, it's about the brand. We've talked about enterprise IT being a luxury market, right? Have we talked about that lately?
Not lately.
Not
but
lately.
Yes, okay. I know. It's a hobby horse you've ridden many times.
Yeah. So the idea is that you're not buying, when you go into a Hermes shop to buy a handbag or a Rolex watch or a, you know, whatever it is, the fancy, you know, or when you go into a Rolls-Royce dealership, it's not actually the car that you're going to buy, you're buying from Rolls-Royce. And I suspect that most enterprise IT companies pay lip service to price, but they're actually buying from Cisco. So whatever Cisco's got or EMC's got or IBM's got or HPE's got, they're going to buy whatever they've got because they want the brand. And the only argument you're having is whether it's a Fendi or Yves Saint Laurent or, you know, some other luxury brand. Because fundamentally, all of the big IT companies are luxury brands, high profit margins, high customer touch, expensive sales. I wrote a blog post this week, which was published on Packet Pushes, where basically the cost of selling 30% of the price, as a rough estimate, 30% of the price that you pay is actually the cost of vendor sales, just literally the sales force and marketing. So if you could just say, take all the sales and marketing away, stop having sales reps come onto your premises and pre-sales engineers and stop having so many white papers and have simpler products that you didn't need, your products could reduce in price by nominally 30%.
So keep going. I mean, I think I know where you're headed here, but yeah, finish this thought because I have a different idea, but go ahead.
So this idea is that enterprise IT doesn't want cheap. They actually want luxury products. That's why we still buy from IBM and, you know, those types of companies. Now, companies like Amazon and Facebook have decided that, you know, buying luxury products doesn't work with their business model. So they're going to go, they've effectively created a Walmart or, you know, an Asda or an Aldi, depending on which country you're in, right? The pound land of this world, and just gone and bought it for the cheapest possible price. And that, for the first time, has given the enterprise IT a choice. You can continue to buy your luxury products, your Rolexes, your gold-plated iPhones, because you're buying them from the brand, but you can start to look at this, and disaggregation is in the face of that. So I don't think Cisco's going to lose, but they're going to shrink as the other market grows, I think.
So I see this a different way. What I'm seeing is that over time, and we're talking a 5 to 10 year horizon here, maybe even longer, enterprises are going to get smart and they're going to get tired of buying the luxury brands because it's pointless. A lot of the basic services for IT that a business needs are commodities, and like the hypervisor at some point became a valueless thing because everybody had one. I think a lot of IT services may be viewed that way. You need to obtain them at the cheapest cost possible because they do what they need to do. So, for instance, Ethernet switching, IP routing and forwarding, at the guts of it, that is the core of what a network needs to provide. There's a lot more services on top of that. I'll give you that. But what do those things need to be in a modern data center? They need to be automatable. They need to be integrated into a larger whole. I believe what Google and Facebook have been showing us and about how they deal with their data centers and how they do IT is going to trickle down into the mass market over time. And the businesses are going to look at these options and go, okay, it's a big culture shift. We got to pull up our pants and, just dive in and make this thing happen. But when we've gotten to the other side, there's going to be a big financial payoff by going cheaper and simpler. Okay, so let's assume that's true. You know, maybe not, but let's assume that's true. And that is the scenario that happens. Then you're looking at switches that are the cheapest things possible because you're going to put a NOS on there that's automatable, that you can fit in with the rest of your operational workflow as you stand up applications. Because it's a commodity, it's a basic service. And if it's Broadcom that's winning the day, Cisco's going to look at that and go, huh, we make a lot of silicon too that's pretty awesome for various reasons. I think Cisco could say, we're going to make an open hardware platform that we will work with operating system vendors to put whatever their NOS of choice is on there.
Well, they don't have to work with those vendors. Other vendors are already ready to run. You know, we've got the switch abstraction interface, SAI, from Microsoft Sonics project to give us a standard way of talking to the silicon. So it doesn't matter whether it's Broadcom or Cavium
and that's where Cisco will have to get into that ecosystem rather than being the standalone that they are now. But yes,
they're not
exactly.
They're not going to do that until the market forces them in that direction because they would be foregoing revenue or, you know, market share
The near term, but in the long term, I think they'd be giving up market share in a big way as enterprises begin shifting over their model.
So if they do it, it'll be a reaction to the market. But I'm saying the counter trend here is that enterprise IT is actually not really cares about how much money it spends on hardware or products. because they're willing, they want to buy a brand. Not they're not buying to a price. They're not price sensitive. They talk about being price sensitive, but they're not, because if they really were, they wouldn't be buying.
They're buying to a comfort level.
Yes, that's right. They're saying our IT is mission critical, therefore we're willing to buy the Rolls Royce of products. And so price is obviously not an issue. That's the truth, right? Now, here's the counter issue. Here's the counter part thing. Obviously, there's a shift to public cloud. So the total size of the market for infrastructure hardware is reducing, and software or infrastructure products generally. But we're also seeing convergence. So when you go to, I went to Dell World as a guest of Dell, so disclosure, and they took us for a tour, and they had this whole campus of people who were building converged systems or rack scale type things. And that literally was, here's a rack and this one runs as your private cloud. And it's got X number of storage arrays in the bottom, X number of servers in the middle, and at the top is two switches. And some of those switches were Dell and running Cumulus. Some of those switches were Dell running FTOS. Some of them were Cisco switches. It just depended on whose, you know, rack thing. So that V-block idea, the VCV block idea, is taking off across the vendors. So you could be, soon you could be buying, you know, the Nutanix hyperconverged or these converged systems where everything's pre-manufactured, and you'll be getting the switches that come with that deal.
I think that's very likely, as a matter of fact. Hyperconverged is an obvious play for the enterprises today. So if we're talking about Google and Facebook techniques, containers and automation trickling down over the next 5 to 10 years, what's going to happen in the near term is hyperconvergence, because it's obvious and easy. A lot of success stories, and much easier to map your operational model over to that than it would be to do the more massive shift to the Giphy Google infrastructure for everyone else way of doing things. And yeah, if you're a hyperconverged player, why would you want to give up the networking component of that revenue? Don't you want to offer the whole stack? Why wouldn't you? Uh-huh. And with so many different options now to stick a switch in the back of that block and automate it as a part of the rest of what you're already automating, standing up VMs, standing up storage, and so on. Yeah, it's a lost revenue opportunity if you don't do that. And so, right, it makes sense that you're going to have switches on board in that hyperconverged block, and you get what you get. And now it's going to open up some brains, I think, open up some minds to be thinking, okay, oh, there's something in the back here I'm not used to, and it works
fine. So that's one thing. Now, there's one more. We can take this one step further. Mm-hmm. Do you remember in show 289, disclosure again, VMware NSX sponsored the show, and they gave us one of their customers to torment. They had 6,000 K-12 students on 8 campuses, and they said they did a VDI solution. Now, I think hopefully I'm remembering this right. 3 people did a VDI solution on 8 servers. Is that the one?
I don't remember the number specifically, but that sounds about right. Yeah, I know it was with a small number of people, they did a pretty massive deployment.
Yeah. And so the flip side of this is you don't actually need hundreds of switches. Like today we have this 3-layered, you know, spanning tree rooted thing, and you have chassis and you have core distribution and access, and every server's got 8 1-gig ports. And so if you've got 100 servers, you've got 1,000 Ethernet ports. Tomorrow, if you have a 10-gig connected server, it'll have 2 10 gigs and that's it. And so we're still seeing, you know, and to deploy 1,000 VDI clients with the latest software, which does all this fancy stuff, you can just use one server to cover 500 to 1,000 people. Whereas 5 or 10 years ago, that would have required 20 or 30 or 50 servers. There's massive changes coming. Like the hardware's gotten better, the software's gotten more efficient. VDI knows where it wants to be. It's doing, you know, memory reuse, all this stuff, right?
You can cram a whole lot of memory and a whole lot of CPU into these boxes now and scale it up. And if now we didn't talk about containers, but by sitting at HP Discover in Las Vegas last week as a guest of the HPE. They were talking about, well, 25 gig, it'll be the next big thing. And I'm like, well, why do we need 25 gig? Because most people aren't filling 10 gig. And they're like, oh, yeah, containers. You can cram so much more compute onto the same footprint, the same number of RUs, that you're going to need 25 gig to get all that data out of the box now, which makes sense to me.
Yeah, somebody explained it to me as there's no way you can drive 25 gig out of a box unless you're using fancy NICs, right? But what's happening is we can certainly drive more than 10 gig out of a server, a modern server. So
interesting. So I actually started digging into this because my brain went, how can I even drive 25 gig? And the bus speeds are, in fact, there with the right interfaces. So I don't know about, you know, LAN on motherboard, where those are coming. HP says, you know, they mentioned 25 gig is only being delivered in a NIC PCIe 3.0 form factor right now, but LOMs are coming. So in theory, you should be able to drive that much.
IEEE still hasn't ratified the 25 gig E standard, believe it or not.
Oh, I thought we were past that hurdle. I thought we covered that.
It was up for discussion in March. They talked about it for 9.5 hours. I looked it up and then decided that they weren't happy with everything and carried it over. So it's still not ratified.
Well, for what it's worth, from an architectural standpoint, just dealing with the PCIe 3.0 bus and 16 lanes, the clock cycles are there that in theory you can drive more than 100 gig out of a box if there aren't, you know, if there aren't bottlenecks somewhere else in the system.
Yeah. I'm not sure that the memory or storage can run that, you know, like you'd have to be running something purely in memory to be able to do that. But I think the story that I've been told from a number of different people is, sure, we probably aren't going to need to do 25 gigs of I/O. That said, there are companies who do want 25 gig and can do. But in normal enterprise IT, we certainly are now seeing applications that want more than 10.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so at that point, do you put in two 10s or four 10s, two pairs of 10s, or do you just go to 125? And 25 is cheaper than two 10s.
Right. Yes. We have architectural choices that are interesting now. Although I kind of paused there for a second. I'm thinking, well, two 10s, actually, I'd go to 225s probably, you know, the way I would stand it up. But that was just my engineer brain kicking in. Sorry.
Is it four 10s in two pair? Cheaper or more expensive than one pair of 25s. So that's kind of the number. Yeah.
That efficiency is going to be there eventually anyway. I mean, I think the cost is going to become a moot point probably in the next year. It wouldn't surprise me.
So here's the thing for you, right? If you're talking about buying a Tomahawk-based or a Jericho-based switch today, so Broadcom, so like the Arista switch that was announced this week, or the Dell, or, you know, whatever, that switch has already got 9,600 gig ports in it. Is it 96? 5,600 gig ports inside. So that gives you 4,800 gig ports with 600 gig ports as a backbone. I think it's six. Anyway, something like that, 64 and whatever. So that means you can use the front ports either as 10, 25, 40, 50, or 100, depending on what cables you break them out. So you can get a breakout cable that goes into the 100 gig port on the front of the switch and gives you 10 10s. Or you can get a breakout cable that gives you 240s. You can get a breakout cable that gives you 425s or 250s, right? Are you ever going to buy another switch for the next 10 years if you've already got a switch that does 48 by 100 gigs?
It's hard to imagine filling that capacity for the average enterprise, for sure. And we've referred to this before, but Ivan Pepelniak has got a reference post on this. Most shops don't need more than two top-of-rack switches, and then he talks through the architecture about why that is. Because the forwarding capacity in these things is so massive that if you've consolidated everything down and you've got assuming you've got the port density, you definitely have the forwarding density or the forwarding capacity that you require into small switches. That's just where we're at. Our ability to forward has not been exceeded by our need to forward yet. We're finally ahead of the game, it seems like.
Yes, I think we're at the point where and innovation in that silicon is not being driven by enterprise IT. So that's my other unicorn, is enterprise IT doesn't drive the technology of today. We just consume whatever's left over from somewhere else, whether it's the smartphone consumer market or it's the public cloud market or it's the service provider market. We get the crumbs that fall from those tables now. But I'm just, you know, if you bought one of those switches, when would you ever replace that 48 by 100 gig ports? And when would you ever need more than two in a data center?
Right. It would become a port density problem before it would become a capacity problem anyway. So,
which is possibly why we haven't seen things like ACI or Nexus 9000 race to embrace 25 gig or 50 gig. They're still just starting to slowly ship their 40 gig versions, which are pretty much obsolete. What we hear is that the cost of 40 gig ports is so much higher than a 25 gig port. Nobody's ever going to use 40 gig in the data center. As an
access layer.
Yeah, that's right. You're not going to have 40 gig coax in a data center. It's always going to be 25 or 50 because of the way that, you know, the Ethernet works. But, coming back to disaggregation, I think disaggregation in that environment becomes absolutely critical, because if that switch has all the capacity that you need for the next years, Now, maybe something will come along that will drive you to upgrade, even though you don't, you're not using the capacity or the process or whatever. You're going to need an operating system on that switch that can innovate over time, because you're not going to want to throw it away.
The interesting bit here is that we're talking about enterprises, or contextually, you know, that's been our context as enterprises. But what's been driving the bigger speeds and the big fabrics and so on have been the cloud providers, where the enterprise workloads are moving to. So that's yet another question that's going to drive some of this as well. Our enterprise is going to start coming back out of the public cloud and continue to build out private or hybrid clouds where they still need local infrastructure? Are they going to keep moving to public? Where does that line get drawn?
So I was doing some work recently. I won't say when, because that would be a bit of a thing. Fundamentally, I've got a blog post, which will publish soonish, saying, can you design a data center at closet scale? So instead of building a data center and custom power and diesel generators and blah, 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 could you design a data center at a closet idea? Going back to where we were 25 years ago in IT, where a server was shoved in a closet.
My gut says yes, but yeah, I'll go ahead. What's the analysis?
Yes.
Well, okay, and so you said that, and my brain immediately said, okay, top of rack switches, one or two of them, tons of forwarding capacity, load up the racks with a storage array, a certain number of servers that's got the compute and memory that you need, which you can pack a massive amount of density into those RUs now, and assuming you can exhaust the heat from the closet, yeah, you could build a huge data center that way.
So how could you address power? How would you solve the power problem? Well, if you're only running a closet, maybe you're only pulling 30 kilowatts, 40 kilowatts at worst. Well, you can UPS that, right? And if the power shuts off, so you don't need to have redundant power for that, if you could shut down 80% of your apps, could you run that for a day on battery packs? Probably.
A lot of battery packs. I mean, you're talking about a lot of space taken up and some weight potentially, but yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree. Do you need a diesel generator out back? No, you could probably get the same power protection you need from batteries. I'll agree. Whatever the form factor might be.
Yeah, if you made some smart choices about attrition, which apps can be shut down. So if there was a power event, could you shut down your mail server? Yeah. If I'm going to save, what's the cost to go and put a mail server in Azure? I think it's like $50 per person per year or something. You know, if you're not going to do that and you decide you want to run it, could you shut it down for a day because of the power outage? Or an hour, maybe. If the power's out to your main building, is there any point in having it powered up? You know, back to where we were 10 years ago, we made decisions like that every week. Anyway, that's one thing. The other way you could do it is you could run your closet at 30 degrees, maybe even 40 degrees, before you have cooling. So if you, instead of refrigerating your servers like we do today, literally refrigerating them, at 16, 17 degrees, because you're always wearing a jacket in the data center, you can easily run modern hardware at 35 degrees, 30 to 35 degrees with no loss of...
Which is quite warm, but Google's already proven that to be true with some of their data center designs. They run super high ceilings, massive convection, run them without HVAC, and just let the heat go up into this high ceiling and draw cool air in from the out of doors to keep them cool. And yes, they run substantially warmer than the data centers that are so cold you have to wear a jacket, which was the last data center I worked in. It was a colo facility. And every time I went in there to do some work, I had to put a jacket on. It was that cold.
But that's a legacy of the days of mainframes, where the cooler to keep them, the less failures they would have, because they were fragile. But it's 2016. You don't even really need to chill a data center at all. Just need to exhaust fresh air, filter from, dust-free air through it. So if you take away the cooling, then your power consumption drops radically. If you do away with redundant, like power generation, like power generators, and just put some UPSs in and then treat it like it's mission critical, you could actually have closet-scale architecture that's pretty good, really.
And it seems... We're so used to the pets, though, my precious storage array that takes up this much of the rack and so on.
Glad you mentioned storage arrays, because one of the problems with storage arrays is that hard drives weigh a lot. And now we have all flash arrays, so now you don't have a weight problem. So, when we go into data centers and you put down a big physical storage array like a VMAX or something like that, and you have to have a specially strengthened floor for it, have you ever done that? And spreader bars.
Yeah. Or you go to wheel it in and realize no one checked with the data center manager before ordering this thing. And now they're trying to find how much weight they can put into a particular data center tile before they're allowed to park it.
Well, that's no longer a problem because all flash arrays are light. They don't weigh tons. They weigh kilos. I checked with some storage people and they said, yeah, no, it's dramatic. They use way less power and way less weight. So you, all of a sudden you don't have to do all that fancy stuff we've been doing for the last 20 years, which has been a massive waste of money and time. So just, you know, this idea of if you look at your data center and say, instead of designing a data center as some cathedral of expense, think about it at closet scale and whether you could make it work.
We are taking a short break from the show to talk about one of today's sponsors, Micronix Training. I can talk about Micronix not just because they are a sponsor, but because I am a Micronix customer. In fact, I have attended multiple CCIE routing and switching boot camps with Micronix over the years with instructor Narbik Kacharians. One boot camp was just before I passed my CCIE routing and switching lab back in 2008, and the most recent one was in the fall of 2015. Micronix boot camps are the real deal. You get detailed workbooks that show you not only what to do, but also the most important part of networking, verifying that what you've configured is working right. You also get live lectures from top-notch instructors. For example, Narbik's lectures are legendary among those of us that have sat in them. He wastes no words while still clearly explaining topics that might have frustrated you before. And you will not see a PowerPoint. It is all whiteboard. It's sort of like being Neo in the Matrix. You leave the lecture feeling like network foo was uploaded directly to your brain. These boot camps aren't just workbooks and lecture, though. You also get time to work on equipment configuration with even more labs designed to teach specific concepts. These boot camps are, if I'm honest, really tough, because if you do everything that's expected of you, your boot camp days will be some of the longest, but most rewarding, 5 or 10 days that you can spend. Which reminds me, Micronix offers several CCIE-level boot camps, including routing and switching, security, data center, and service provider. Some of them are 5 days, some of them are 10 days, and if you're not working on a CCIE certification, Micronix offers instruction in several other courses, including CCNA, CCNP, DCICN, CCDE, and more. So to learn from the best, head over to MicronixTraining.com. Micronix is an authorized Cisco Learning Partner, and they accept Cisco Learning Credits. One more time, that's MicronixTraining.com. And please, when you sign up for a course or a boot camp, let them know that Packet Pushers sent you. Another question here worth discussing. Does open networking mean free from vendor lock-in? This idea comes up over and over again where I hear the open networking people, the disaggregation people saying, yeah, you buy the hardware and you can put whatever NAS on there you want and you're free from vendor lock-in. You've got choice. You can do whatever you want. And I've kind of bought into that because it's true. You do have choice, right? Just like you can buy a server with Linux on it and change it to Windows someday or whatever else you might like. Does that mean the same thing in open networking? And is that a big sell? Who really cares about this if I'm free from vendor lock-in? The more I'm thinking about this, the more I'm going, I don't know how much this really matters. Yeah, it's a thing and it's interesting, but you know, does it really impact me in real life? Because lock-in isn't just about my software only runs on my hardware, right? That, well, if you buy Cisco, it's got to have, you know, iOS running on its, you know, their branded switch. And that's the only way it works is so you're locked into them. I mean, of course, Cisco's always the target. But I don't think lock-in's just about that. Lock-in is also about technical debt, or maybe I should say technical inertia would be a different way to put it. You know, and my idea here is you as an organization, you make a choice for some hardware-software combination, whether it's open networking or something else. Then you're going to build an operational process around it. To add a VLAN, you do this. And to add new routes, you do this. And when you build an ACL, it looks like this. And when we stand up a new application in a DMZ, the networking looks like, and you've got all these documents and processes and things that you create over time that are very reliant on how that switch functions and how the operating system functions. Now that you've done that, it's hard to change. And so you've still got lock-in of a sort. Maybe it's not vendor lock-in, but you're still locked in. So what's really different here? I mean, yeah, you can load any operating system you want, but then you're going to stick with that thing. You know, just like you could run anything you want on that x86 box, but do you? Yes, you can change, but I don't think that means that you will change. And so is being free from vendor lock-in really such a big sell for the open networking movement?
I like what you say about the lock-in, right? You're correct. Although I like to think of lock-in as lack of exit strategy. So whatever decision you make, have an exit strategy that gets you back out the other side. And so when we talk about lock-in, it's like you make a decision to use EIGRP, there's no exit. You have to replace everything. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's what lock-in means. Lock-in doesn't mean, it means you can't exit. You can't go anywhere else without overcoming a hurdle or a moat. You have to exit the moat that the vendor's using to protect their product.
Yeah, it's fair to call that a technical debt problem, I think. Yeah.
Yes. The flip side of that is, of course, that you might choose to take a lock-in product to get access to features for a better price or a speed to market. Like all the SDN WAN vendors, none of them interoperate today. So if you bought a Viptela and a Telari, they wouldn't be able to interoperate today. But on the flip side of that, you're saving so much money, you'd be crazy not to get the lock-in, if that makes sense. So you're never free of vendor lock-in at any level, because not only is it the vendor lock-in, you've also got vendor lock-in in terms of your purchasing department, who has prevents you from setting up accounts with suppliers. Yeah?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
then you've got tech support. So once you've set up a tech support with a particular vendor, you get to know how their tech support works, and you have their numbers, and you load them into your help desk system. And so that's a lock-in, right?
Well, we need to be locked in on how heavily to sigh before we dial those support numbers, too. That's really important.
Mm. Yeah, or, you know... And it's really only a matter of time until they disappoint you at the end of the day. Tech support's not all it's cracked up to be. But I guess, you know, any decision that you make, like the decision to use Microsoft Word, locked in. You're stuck with the .doc format. But everybody else is using Microsoft Doc. Does that make it a bad decision? You could write in plain text but to be open, but the trade-off is that writing in plain text is not what people are expecting, even though they used to use typewriters in plain text. We seem to have forgotten that plain text was the precursor to not plain text like Word. To me, the lock-in is every decision you make is a lock-in. If you decide to implement BGP, you're locked into BGP for the next 30 years in your data center, right?
You're just reinforcing my point. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you just so does open networking mean free from vendor lock-in? And I think we're both saying for different reasons, not really. I mean, yes, plausibly, but not actually, just because of the way IT processes work. This be interesting because this could get even more complicated with APIs and automation, where you're reliant on a particular API to do things for you, to have those calls available and have particular response sets available so that your automation system works as intended. And as soon as that API is no longer available to you, it's an issue. It's going to disrupt your operations. And so you're locked in just in a different way now. So, yeah.
So the question is, which lock-in do you want? And you should be trying to make the best decisions you can manage. And the thing to be looking for is an exit strategy. If I take this decision and I go into this protocol or into this vendor or into this technology, what's my exit strategy to the other end? I think as a designer, you've always got to be having one eye on the exit door, just like having a job, right? Just because you love your current employer and love your current job, chances are within a certain period of time, usually 3 to 5 years, you'll want to leave. Always have an eye on the door, right? Be prepared for it. Same thing with any technology decision. Always be prepared for that technology to fail or to be obsoleted or to be irrelevant or to something. So you need to exit to the next story. And that's what you're looking for. Is your data portable? Is the routing protocols compatible with something else? So like BGP EVPN to do VXLAN overlays is standardized. So in a hypothetical world, you could use BGP EVPN to put Brocade and Juniper and Cisco all into one data center.
So you've got another unicorn to ride around on. I'm looking at our outline here. Vendors are not liable for their products or solutions, which is something I've heard you get a bit ranty about before. Explain this, Mr. Farrow.
So one of the things is a lot of people say we're not allowed to use open source because there's no legal liability, although increasingly companies are growing up and getting used to that. Because what they say is if something goes wrong with the product, we need to be able to sue a vendor to recover our assets or to transfer risk.
Which happens all the time. Actually, yeah. I've never heard of that happening, but okay, yep.
Yeah, right? But you've heard people say that all the time. Oh, we have to buy from a branded vendor because they stand behind their product.
And I've worked in companies where the legal department scrutinized all the verbiage coming in from the vendor before they would allow us to make the purchase. Yes.
But the dirty little secret is no court case has ever been successful with this.
When someone has taken a vendor to court, you're meaning the enterprise did not win, the vendor won.
Yes. Or the court case went nowhere, or there was so much money expended to try and make it work. Like, there's a state in the US somewhere that's suing Oracle for a failed project. They're already 3 years into the court case, and it's still got years to run. They will never get that $700 million back. Right. And basically, if you look back over the last 30 years of IT, the vendors basically sell you a product with zero consumer guarantees. They have no obligation to sell you a product that works, or that it meets the specifications that they promised, or that it will continue to work over time.
Like, I'm trying to imagine an auto manufacturer trying to sell me a car that like that. You know, because even they have guarantees to a point. You know, once you've used it beyond 3 years, 36,000 miles, or whatever the specific warranty is, then you're on your own. But at least you get an initial out of the gate. This brandy new car should work amazingly for you. And if it doesn't, by golly, we're going to fix it. And they back up. Yeah. But not in IT.
Like, some states have lemon laws. So if you get show a history of failed, you know, oh, this was broken, that was broken, they're forced to pay you back, to at least give you your costs back.
But again, not IT. No IT. Implication of warranty expressed, implied, or otherwise. And if you start reading through the agreements, it's all, you're using this at your own risk.
Yes.
Most of those, we just click OK, or, you know, it's a piece of paper in the box that we never read because we're going to use it. We have to use it to get our jobs done. But if you do go through the legal verbiage on some of these things, it's comical to the point of depressing. Or is it depressing to the point of comical, perhaps?
So my point here is like, you know, Cisco gives you a hardware warranty of 90 days, hardware and software warranties of 90 days. Is their product that bad and so unreliable that that's all they can do? Anyway, that's I'm being a little bit cynical there, but to me it just seems like our industry, what made sense 20 years ago was right. Products were unreliable, they were unsafe. But in 2016, I do believe that technology needs to move forward, or you need to say, I should be taking open source software because at least it's free and it has no better or no worse guarantees than what I'm getting from my products today.
Yeah, I felt that way for a while. Although there is a point to be made here that some of the open source projects that are out there, I'm starting to hear this from friends of mine. I am not a software developer where I dig through code and can critique it. I have some programming background, but I do not do that. I have friends that do, and I'm not going to throw any particular open source project under the bus, but it is worth mentioning that some of these open source projects just have bloody awful code that these people are looking at it going, I am not running that. Not that that takes away from your point, Greg, because now you're shifting, you're de-risking your software purchase by taking the burden of cost. Rather than having a big CapEx or some kind of subscription, you're moving it to the quote-unquote free open source software that does what you need it to do. And then taking your risk there and bringing in costs a different way, learning how to use it, bending it to what you need it to do for your environment, et cetera. You know, is it better or worse? I think that's going to depend on the project. I also have been criticized in the past for saying some newer network operating systems were just as good as anything Cisco puts out because, oh my gosh, there's so many bugs in Cisco or Junos or any of the established vendors' code as well. So who are we kidding here? And some people have criticized me and said, well, those older code bases are, you know, battle hardened and the newer stuff, you don't know what you don't know. I don't know, man. I guess I lean towards where you're at. Anything that's new code has a significant amount of risk with it because software development as a practice does not produce winning code out of the gate, at least not most of the time.
No. And I guess it's just many of these vendors are not very good software developers. They're better at eventually getting it right. You know, the Microsoft 3 upgrades, you know, they release something 3 times before it stabilizes. Cisco is 3 to 5 years. Release a product and then wait 3 to 5 years before you can start using it because it takes that long to work the bugs out. You know, IBM, similar sort of story, same thing.
It's been axiomatic in IT for years. You never put a .0 release from a vendor into production. You just don't. Yeah. You let someone else do that and work out the bugs. You put in .1 or .2. You know, some subsequent updated version when those initial bugs that hit other people's production has been resolved. Now it's much safer for you to go ahead and do your thing.
So the point I'm trying to make here is that your perception of risk with a vendor is fundamentally identical as your real risk with open source, right? So the real risk of working with a vendor is that there are no guarantees. You can't prosecute. You're only going to ever recover the cost of the product. You're never going to get liquidated damages. So that is, you know, if this product fails and takes your site, your company down, and your company goes broke, you can't sue them to recover that money. They're not going to take that liability. That's not possible. The best you'll get is that the product that blew up, you can get a refund on it. If that's the case, then open source looks very good. The second part about this is that open source quality, so if a vendor is going to sell you something for money, the product quality has to be better than open source. So for the first time ever, we now have a benchmark for vendor quality. That is, if I'm buying a network monitoring solution from a vendor and paying dollars, it has to be better in terms of features and reliability and tech support than this open source project over here. I mean, how many times have we heard people say, I'm not buying logging software like Splunk or whatever. I'm just going to go and use Elasticsearch because it's easy, it works, it's reliable, and the support from the community is awesome. Why would you pay for commercial log collection software when you've got this perfectly acceptable free software instead?
Yeah, particularly when support organizations have tended to let us down over the years. First-tier support is generally useless, unfortunately.
You know, this is the transition I'm going through in my mind, and it comes back to this disaggregation thing, right? If I'm going to buy, maybe you're going to start thinking to yourself, will I buy an open source operating system? Maybe I'll use an open source operating system. So a company came out of stealth today called SnapRoute, and SnapRoute has written open-sourced a whole bunch of routing protocols, OSPF, BGP, all completely written from the ground up in Go. I'm not sure how they're going to commercialize, but for now, maybe you can now go and buy or go and use an open source version of a BGP protocol. Now, if you can go and do that for nothing, for free, just your time to make it work, and if there's a good community that's supporting it and making it happen and that's the right sort of project, the vendor solutions like Dell's are building OS X, and they're going to produce commercial BGP implementations that you buy to run on top of their OS X. Hey, HPE's got OpenSwitch. You've got other companies who will produce like Infusion and Oknos and so forth. Those implementations have to be so much better quality because you're paying for them, right?
For what it's worth, the Linux Foundation has OpenSwitch now, but it's certainly HPE behind it, yeah.
Yeah. My point is that for the first time, you can now hold the vendors to account for poor quality products by saying, if I go and get this for free and it works at this level, your product, I'm paying for it. Why is your product not as good as this open source product? And you can put them over a barrel and make them squirm.
So looking at it from another perspective, yes, I agree. You can use that as a stick to hit your vendor with. That's fair. That's actually good leverage. You know, on the other hand, you know, if we look at a lot of what networking features and functions are that we have out there, many of the bugs are tied in some obtuse way to some, as you put it, wanker knob that got baked in there 10 years ago for some customer that no one's using anymore, and somehow it, you know, bites us in the rear end 10 years later. If we begin in these open source projects to provide networking a core set of basic services that everybody needs and makes them reliable, you're going to have an even bigger stick to hit your vendor with, because I don't need all of the stuff that you're throwing in there and with the kitchen sink and all. I need these things, and you can build your laundry list of what those things are. And this OS that I can get open source provides that for me. Why do I need to go to you? And it becomes, it ends up that the core functionality of networking is, in a sense, valueless, in the same sense that a hypervisor is valueless now.
So this brings me to another discussion, right? DevOps. So if we're going to do NetOps, like what we're talking about here, can you outsource this? Who's going to manage that infrastructure? Can you say outsource it to IBM or one of the resellers or one of the, you know, are you going to be in a position if you're running open source software to outsource?
Well, to outsource which? Which specifically are we looking at? Standing up the infrastructure?
Yeah. Yeah. So imagine if you're, I don't know, Computer Center, who's one of the big, like, or Tata or one of the big outsourcing companies, right? What's the value in giving an outsourcing contract to these people when a lot of this is highly customized to you, right? So one of the things we're seeing is that outsourcing is dying, being dramatically wound back. People are exiting their outsourcing contracts. Yeah, I know there's some headlines where they're still shifting businesses to India, but those companies are as much re-engineering their workflows as they are, you know, outsourcing their legacy IT is perfectly reasonable in my view, because legacy IT is badly put together. They should be focusing on transformation into some sort of modern IT, you know, replacing. But a lot of companies can't think like that, right? If you're outsourcing, can you do, but look at what we do in the cloud with DevOps and automation and stuff like that. You're going to end up hiring bodies to do DevOps, right?
It's got to be in-house, because you really hit the nail on the head early on when you said it's all highly customized. Yeah, it's going to be a highly customized set of processes and automation to stand up apps that are specific to what your organization is producing. I don't know about highly specialized, but there's definitely, you're going to want infrastructure engineers working with your developers in a full-time relationship to make sure that the application deployment process continues to be a smooth one as business evolves within that company. And I'm trying to figure out how you would outsource that. And that seems like an impossible task. You need people that know your processes internally to make that happen.
You know, this pet theory I have is that for the last 10 years, our job has been, you know, our CIOs have just reduced headcount in IT because it's a cost. And DevOps, if you look at it in one point of view, is saying, actually, we need to do better IT, so we need to hire people back. But instead of holding them in the infrastructure, we're putting them closer to the development cycle. The challenge comes when you then say, I need to outsource this. And the trend for outsourcing is largely dying. It's largely been proved to be a false hope. Like, there are things that you can outsource. So my pet theory is you can outsource cleaning of toilets, because validating that your toilets have been cleaned is a reasonably easy thing to do, right? Your testing strategy is straightforward. But if you outsource your network, how can you validate that your network is being managed at a level of quality that's acceptable? We don't have the technology to monitor a network to acceptable levels of quality yet.
And I think it's one of the reasons that outsourcing has been failing anyway. Just you know, besides the expense of it, you're just not getting the service that you were promised that you would get. Mm. You were going to get more for less, and it's ended up being less for more with most outsourcing, I think.
Well, and also it becomes mutable. So once you set up a contract and you say, this is the contract and here's it is for 5 years, and this, the outsourcing, and then all of a sudden IT is changing like on a, I don't know, 2-year, 3-year cycle now, but you've got a 5-year contract and you're locked into it, and they're saying, we're not changing anything because it'll cost them money. And they're trying to extract profits out of your operational process. I never quite understood outsourcing. I understand the desire to change things. Like, outsourcing is very useful for change. Like, how do I re-engineer people? How do I change their minds? How do I get rid of an old application? I don't have the capability to throw it away and replace it with a new app. So maybe if I outsource it, I can pretend it's not a problem that I've got. So
going back to DevOps, though, I think if you end up with an IT infrastructure that you are able to manage in a kind of a hands-off way, once you've got it set up, you kind of go into maintenance mode. You don't need a ton of people to do this. You can manage a lot more with fewer bodies as well. I think you want them to be full-time bodies, not outsourced bodies, but you don't have to have a massive fleet of infrastructure, like midline provisioning engineers, because you've got so many pieces of equipment that need to be touched during any given week. You can do a lot more with less now, I think, once the systems are in place.
I think so. And I mean, the other thing is that outsourcing, when I was employed by outsourcers, my goals were aligned to the outsourcer, not to the customer. Like, that's, and let me be clear, my primary goals were aligned to the outsourcer. My secondary goals were aligned to the customer.
Yeah, your primary goals when you were working for that customer was to think of ways to do upsell and so on. Yes, you had to fulfill a contract and you had work to do, but you also had half an eye to, and what else could we sell these guys? And what other things should I, you know, maybe run up the flagpole to? I've been in that same kind of situation, right?
And so does the customer, we all give lip service, you know, the customer is the most important thing. Actually, the customer is never the most important thing. Your employer is the most important thing. And then the customer, you know, that's the really.
It's the way it is, yeah.
It's the way it is, right? And when you work for an outsourcer, it's much more complicated, because your employer, then it's your outsourcer who is your customer. And then it's the customer. And then it's, you know, and so on down the line. We all try to do our best, but the systems inherently are not optimized for success. They're optimized to fail, as far as I can see. You know. But it made sense when IT wasn't changing. Like, when IT was static, like we had that time from the mid-1990s to the late late 2000s, when IT didn't really change. All we got was bigger servers every now and then, but we still all used Microsoft Word. We all ran the same laptops. We all ran the same, you know, Microsoft server on the desktop. But all of a sudden, since, say, 2011, everything's changed. We're all switching from Windows to Linux. We're switching to a faster cycle. We're switching to virtualization. Apps are changing at a much faster rate. People are abandoning email and desk phones. They're moving to, you know, chat sessions. All this stuff has changed so much in just a very short period of time. I wouldn't like to be writing an outsourcing contract right now. What would you write an outsourcing contract at? We should talk about P4.
Well, you did the show with Nick. P4 is not programmable silicon, right? It's the language that can be used to program silicon. And I think I know the announcement you're heading towards, but just it really was conceived as a way to overcome. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Greg, but my perception of it, it's a way to overcome some of the limitations that we've run into with OpenFlow. It was really designed, you know, from the ground up as a different way to manage entries that are going into the silicon and do a lot of things with it, including program pipelines and do different stuff within programmable silicon to do all sorts of whatever you might want if you really have custom needs for what is going through your switch. Now, you did the show with Nick, so tell me what I just got right and what I just got wrong there.
So you got everything pretty much right. So the idea is that today we have a CPU, which is a set of primitives, but it doesn't actually do, when it processes packets, it's not optimized to do packet processing. It's optimized to run x86 code, right? So why don't we have that for our ASICs? ASICs are fundamentally a fixed function chip that does one thing, forwarding packets. But we can also do packet forwarding in things like FPGAs, you know, about floating point gate arrays, which are programmable silicons. And we've also got network processors. So we have companies like Netronome and Mellanox and a couple of others. And they have these processors which are programmable packet processors. So why don't we have that in our switch? Why don't we have silicon in our switch, which is independent of the protocol, that allows us to be programmable for networking data?
Because it's expensive to make that silicon. There's a longer development cycle versus a static ASIC, is my understanding. But yes.
I'm not too sure if I actually understand the business reasons. I suspect the networking market wasn't big enough to justify making general purpose chips, because, you know, ultimately it's not that many chips in networking, right? And the second part is that the cost of manufacturing silicon was very high. But there's been a turnabout now, where the cost of designing chips and manufacturing them is now sort of becoming commoditized. You know, I go on about the commoditization trend. So Barefoot Networks has come out of stealth. They've announced a thing called the Tofino silicon, which is a fully programmable chip. And it's based around this concept of match action. So they say here it's merchant silicon with a fully programmable parser. That is, as a signal comes in on the wire, you can fully programmably parse the digital signal coming off the wire, the bits. So that means an arbitrary packet format. It can be Ethernet. Maybe you could implement your own IPX format. Maybe you could implement a wholly customized packet format if that makes you happy. But what most people would use it for is to decode their own tags. You can create your own MPLS tag, make it 200 bytes long and stuff it full of information. And then once you come into the pipeline, what it's actually full of is generic match action logic. So what it would do is your parser reads the chip cycle, and then it has this cascading filter of match, 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 match. And when it matches, it then performs an action. And that is quite deep. It's very difficult to explain verbally, so you're going to have to read an article or look for a link to see how the silicon goes together. But basically what it means is we're now able to have arbitrary packet formats in the network. When I say arbitrary, it means you can design your own. In addition, you can modify the packets as they flow through these switches on your own terms. You can make your own MPLS tag. You can inject an entirely proprietary tag that you like. Remember we talked about network services header with Dave Ward 6-8 months ago? And they're talking about like a 160-bit header, if I remember rightly, network services. And it's NSH,
I don't think it was quite that big. But yes, there was plenty of room for metadata for the service chain. Yeah.
Yeah. So now what happens is, let's say you have a data center network full of all of these switches powered by this protocol independent switch architecture. You could actually have in your server on the NIC, right? As the packet comes in, you can then put a tag in there that says server so and so, this much CPU, this much buffer, exit it. And then when it arrives on a switch, you can add another tag. When it leaves the switch, add another tag. When it leaves, and so on and so forth, as it crosses your network, right? There's no reason why you can't use that as a form of telemetry. So when the server at the other end receives the packet, it can read that data, send it off to a telemetry server, who can then look for where in the pipeline, where in the forwarding plane, the delay or there, whether it was packet loss or where there was some problem.
But the real question with all this, okay, so you have telemetry as a potential use case that you're sharing there because you can shove that metadata that would help us come to some telemetry conclusions along the way. But, you know, by and large, who's going to use this stuff? Now, I'm going to go back in time here. You think about Enterasys and going back to the Cabletron days, the CoreFlow ASIC they had could do a lot of this kind of stuff that you're talking about. They were shoving some, if you were within their world, shoving a packet through their network and through that CoreFlow ASIC, there was interesting extra bits they could have in there that helped them with telemetry and things like authentication state for flows and a lot of other stuff, which was really cool. And they demoed a lot of their apps. It was like amazing. They were a decade ahead of their time. No one bought any of it. Now the Extreme's bought them and most of the technology is just slowly going down the drain. Okay, now we've got P4 and we've got this, I forgot the name of the silicone, what the branding was already, but Tofino, okay.
T-O-F-I-N-O or T-O-L, I don't know, T-O-F-I-N-O, I'll go with that, yeah.
Who's going to use this and do something interesting with it? Or is it really a proof of concept exercise kind of demonstrating what you could do?
So I think the first people to use it will be the cloud providers, you know, the Facebook, Azure, Google, Rackspace, right? They'll take it and start to use the silicon so that they can use it as a telemetry system to monitor packet forwarding in their data centers. And if the silicon proves out and it's reliable and it's stable and it's performant and it's blah, 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 then I think you'll see, I would imagine that if I could predict something, Barefoot Networks will issue a license for that design so other people could manufacture it. Or maybe somebody will buy Barefoot and start producing that silicon so anybody can use it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you've released a chip, which is a design. They're trying to find a market. But I do believe this is the long-term future. So instead of having these chips in the switches, which are fixed, packet comes in, Ethernet, IP, L4, L7, queuing, buffering, exit, right? And that's fixed pipeline. And there's nothing more. So when VXLAN came around, we could only strip the L2 header off it. We couldn't then route it because you could only do L2, L3, and then exit. You couldn't strip the L2 VXLAN header and then route the layer 2 and then put it back in to the VXLAN and rotate it around. There's no recirculation in the pipeline. This silicon can do that. So it's probably the evolution.
So there's another vendor here, Corsa, that we're both familiar with that has very similar sorts of capabilities. Mm-hmm. And I anticipate that they'll support P4 at some point if they have customers that want them to use it. Or that want to use P4 to program them. But again, even from what Corsa is telling me, even though their FPGAs have all of these capabilities, most customers don't use them that way necessarily. It's more about the programmability of the interface.
So Barefoot's advantage is it has Nick McEwen. Yeah, Nick McEwen. They're in Silicon Valley. They're not in Canada. They're plugged into a lot of people. They're talking directly to the people who matter inside of, you know, Facebook, Amazon, Google, you know, Azure, Google, those types of people.
Right? I'm just making the point that I think it's a corner case for the vast majority of the industry. Will there be a few large players that find this to be the coolest thing that solves specific problems for them? Sure. Most of us don't have those problems.
I see it as the x86 of networking. Hmm. This is the precursor of a silicon design. It's a proof of concept. It's the first one that says you can build a universal CPU or a universal switching engine that can do anything.
That is really interesting. You said x86 instruction set of networking because we used to say that about OpenFlow.
Mm. Hmm. So but this is the silicon this time, right?
Yep.
So the lesson that we learned from OpenFlow is match action. And what I've got to be able to do is do a lot of matches and a lot of actions. And I've got to be able to do it for an arbitrary packet format. The idea of a 13 tuple, you know, the OpenFlow tuple that was 12 mm-hmm. to 13 big things long, right. That wasn't flexible enough or there was problems because the current ASICs couldn't support it. The Barefoot Tofino is specifically designed to be ultimately flexible. Now, people may not go back to OpenFlow. They may use it for different things, but this is the template for a processor that for whatever function you want it to do, this processor can do it. MPLS, routing, encapsulation, design your own encapsulation. Maybe you wanted to do IPv4, maybe you want to do IPv6, maybe you want to create your own completely non-standard IP, new packet format. I don't know, for whatever reason. Maybe you decide that TCP/IP header is inefficiently designed. Maybe you want to do, in-flight modification on the packet. So you want to rewrite the packet as it goes through the switch.
I mean, are they manufacturing this thing at scale so that the chipset is going to be quite affordable, or is it going to be reassuringly expensive?
I don't know. They've just come out of stealth. This is what they've announced. I'm excited because I think, I do believe that this is a chance for an x86 networking process or networking engine that we can get away from this ASIC, that ASIC, this ASIC, that, this feature is possible in this ASIC. We can do this, You remember when we started talking about Genova and VXLAN and NVGRE, and we wanted to do Trill, right? We wanted to do Trill or SPB. Well, what if you could just do all of those things on the same ASIC, and you didn't have to wait for a respin of the ASIC to come out?
It still would be a significant upgrade. It'd be effectively a firmware upgrade. But yes, your point stands. I know what you're saying.
Or a fiber channel. You can turn the same silicon could work for fiber channel because the packet format for fiber channel is fundamentally identical to Ethernet.
One of the exciting things about SPB was just about any chipset could do it because it was Mac and Mac and everybody had that.
Yep.
Didn't require something different sort of a header like Trill did. So, yeah.
All it needed was some software. So this chip could do all of those. So you could take a chip, you could buy a Tofino enabled switch, use it for SPB today, but tomorrow you could use it for Trill.
I don't know. Okay. Let me play devil's advocate again here on this. Okay. If you back up a step and think about where all of the magical packet formatting is happening today, where is that being done? It's being done in the vSwitch on x86, and there's all this energy being done in the industry to make x86 more efficient and better at doing those processes, so it takes fewer cores, so it takes less of a load on whatever else might be running on that system. I think it's a great idea, but I just can't see it becoming the way we do networking going forward, a general purpose, I was going to say ASIC, but it isn't, it's an FPGA, with an instruction set. It's like the right answer, but the way the industry is tooled and with all the competition that's out there and all the other business manufacturing processes that are in place and the way we consume networking, it's an incredible uphill battle for them to take the industry by storm. And that's not my argument against, just the way I think it's likely to play out over the next few years.
Yes, no, it's definitely got to get uphill. But my hope is that this could be the universal processor concept. So you could have this processor equally in a NIC as you could in a switch, as you could in a router, as you could be, and it could be support an infinite array of protocols. So in the network, or an infinite number of operations on the packet or the frame as it goes through the device.
I like what you're handing me. I mean, I'm looking in the cup. It's a great color. It swirls. It's got a good bouquet. I just don't know that I want to drink it. I don't know, man. I don't know.
All right.
The nerd in me says, oh, yes, please, but I don't know.
I'm hopeful, right? I'm always hopeful for change. I'd like to embrace these ideas and think about the what ifs. It'd be nice to be able to rewrite frames arbitrarily. And, literally, if you say, oh, I want fabric path, just write a fabric path implementation and then push the software, update the software on your switch. Boom, away you go. But equally, the P4 language that programs this, which Barefoot also designed, can be used in the NIC. If you've got a network processor in the NIC, you can start to say, well, I'll use P4 here. And it's an end-to-end. It's not just in the network itself. Don't forget that P4 can be used to program virtual switches. So if you decide to define your own, maybe you want an MPLS tag that's 200 bits long, and you want to put signaling data in that tag for some reason, I don't know, whatever. You can do that because you can program it in the NIC or the virtual switch, or you can do it in the physical switch in the network or the router.
Well, dear listener, you've been listening to us for over an hour now, so we're going to shut up. I am Ethan Banks, at EC Banks on Twitter. Greg is, of course, at Ethereal Mind. You can find us at packetpushers.net, our blogs, another place. Just Google us. We're out there. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts and our community blog that is real engineers writing about the stuff they do every day, operations and code and problem solving and design and so on. That's all at packetpushers.net as well, and it's all free. Follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. We're on LinkedIn. We're on Facebook. You can rate us on iTunes if you would, please. That would not suck of you if you did that. That'd be great. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.